Welcome back to the Hip Hop Social Worker Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. And today I have a very special guest, my good friend, Tori.
What's up?
How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Thanks for finally having me.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we were talking about this for about a year.
Yeah, about that. Yeah, yeah.
And then so it took so long, you even started your own podcast.
I did start my podcast. You inspired me, actually.
You know, I wish I could inspire more. I really want people to see that if they want to do it, it is just maybe a couple hundred dollars of not even that, of some equipment and going for it.
Yeah, no, when we started ours, it was like, I think we bought a $40 mic set, and then we were just using it plugged into the phone with the Anchor podcast app.
Damn.
Yeah, we were low budget.
Y'all going hard, okay.
We've stepped our game up a little bit, got a little bit more fancy equipment, but no, seriously, you totally inspired me because I had been wanting to do one for a while, and I had like thrown some ideas around in my head, and then my friend and I, we would spend a lot of time together talking about news and, you know, all the crazy stuff in the news and stuff like that. And she was like, you know, we should do a podcast. And I was like, I've been wanting to do a podcast. And then I told her about you. I was like, yeah, I know this guy. I work with him. He has a podcast. He says it's not that, you know, hard, boop, boop, boop. And I was like, fuck it, let's do it. And so we did it.
That's usually how it starts.
Yeah, so we did it.
So I want to give a little bit of background about yourself.
Background about myself, like, what do you want to know?
Well, you know, like, maybe like professional.
You know, the standard, dominant culture norms of tell me about yourself.
Yeah, of course.
Just playing. So let's see, professionally, since 1995, when I was still working on my undergrad in criminal justice, I worked in the juvenile justice system. I worked detention, then I finished my undergrad and went straight into juvenile probation work. I did that till 2013.
Yeah.
I worked a bunch of different counties in the state, kind of moved my way up I-5, ended up in Multnomah County. That's where I finished my juvenile probation officer career.
Okay.
Worked with mainly gang youth. I speak Spanish fluently, so that was a needed skill in probation. So I did that. And then, 2011, I guess it will be. So I had a supervisor during my probation years, not on probation, but my probation years, that he was a social worker. So he just kept saying, you need to go to social work school. You need to go to grad school. And I'm like, I don't need to go to grad school. I don't need those letters. Yeah. I know what I'm doing, you know, boop, boop, boop. Like, no, you need to go, need to go. So this guy worked on me like, I would say for like 4 years, just go, go, go. And finally I was like, fine, I'll apply, you know? And so I applied and, you know, got in and, went into PSU and did the 2-year program and worked full time at the same time. I do not suggest that for anybody. I don't know how I survived it. I actually did the administration leadership track.
Yeah.
You know, because my goal was in working with gang youth that are involved in gangs, I kind of really noticed like there wasn't programs that weren't punitive.
Yeah.
Right. And so it didn't take into account all the things the kids that were in gangs had gone through.
Yeah.
Right. So I was like, you know, my dream was to create some sort of program that would be holistic in nature, that would provide mental health, would provide, you know, job skills, and just I had a really big dream about it.
Yeah.
So that's why I chose administration leadership, because I thought, well, if I'm going to help create a program or, you know, maybe apply to be a supervisor in a program, you know, that would be the road to go. And, you know, 6 years later, here I am still in direct service work. I've done a myriad of things. I did, I started out as child and family therapist.
Okay.
And like we were talking about before, I really find it interesting how they just kind of hand you the work.
Yeah.
You know, and they say, go for it.
Figure it out.
You know. And so I did that for a minute, and then I did some crisis response work. And then I did some, it's called health resilience. So it's kind of like medical, social work type thing, working with people with chronic illnesses. And then I spent a minute at the Portland Public Schools.
That's where we met.
Yeah. And I literally, it felt like a minute.
Yeah.
And then now I'm back doing therapist work. So it's kind of like the road of my social work, criminal justice then to social work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't really see that path a lot, like criminal justice into social work.
No, no.
It's like criminal justice into like, well, a cop or.
Yeah.
Well, you were a PO.
Yeah. So. And I actually tried to be a cop. Early on,
yeah.
I applied for a couple different forces, police forces, agencies, whatever. Couldn't pass that physical, man.
Mm.
It's brutal.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's brutal, man. The running part always got me.
Yeah.
I got short little legs, a stout body, and I could not pass that physical test. But, you know, in a way, it's like I look back and I think, you know, it's kind of a blessing in disguise because knowing what I know now, I don't think I would have made a good police officer.
Probably not.
I mean,
that's just me knowing you and how much you speak up for stuff.
Yeah.
It would have been hard.
It would have been really stressful.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I probably would have gotten sucked in and eaten up by the old boy system or spoke out too much and been, you know, kind of ostracized.
Yeah.
So, you know, things happen for whatever reason.
That is true. So, like, what kind of stuff did you, like, do growing up to kind of lead to, like, your passion in criminal justice?
Wow. So,
I won't call it a passion, but, you know.
I was a good kid.
Yeah.
I was a good kid growing up. I grew up in a very small town in Southern Oregon, like 1,000 people. So, I was a really good student. I was an athlete, played 3 sports. You know, for me, it was more of I started to find interest in crime in probably the late 80s, early 90s when Ted Bundy had gotten arrested. And, you know, that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And I really got interested in serial killers, which I think back now and I look and, you know, think about my room as a child. And I had literally had like articles of Ted Bundy on the wall.
Yeah.
And so I think about like now, like if somebody would have saw that, like, oh man, she maybe got problems, you know?
Well, Ted Bundy had a lot of people that loved him.
Oh yeah. No, he was very popular. He was, you know, so I kind of got interested in the crime aspect through that. And it was just something that I always wondered, why do people do what they do to people? You know, originally I was going to go into advertising. Like that was, I started as a business major.
So did I.
And so, I mean, I think I watched a lot of TV. I always liked watching commercials.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, that would be fun to make ads. And, you know, and so that's how I kind of entered my undergrad. So I would say growing up, it wasn't like any one thing that moved me to probation. It was more like I was interested in true crime, read the Ann Rule books, and then I went to college thinking I was going to be a business major. And then I took a business memo writing class. And so we had to write, you know, just a business memo on something.
Yeah.
And I ended up writing it about some sort of true crime thing.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I think I want to do, you know, and then Silence of the Lambs came out. And so I was like, oh, now I'm going to be a, you know, FBI agent. But that I found out you had to be really smart for that.
Oh, you know, like really clean.
Yeah, really clean. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't. You can't have anything in your background.
Yeah, you can. Like,
your
cousins
can't be anything. Yeah. Yeah.
That's definitely some good old systematics right there.
You know, exactly.
Keep the riffraff
out. Oh, yeah, exactly. You got to keep the trash out.
Yeah. I say trash with air quotes.
yes, definitely.
But so now you're back doing therapy after a whole wide range of jobs and titles and, you know, experiences. What kind of things do you like enjoy about doing therapy?
You know, I think I like making that connection, you know, for people, helping people make the connection.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's kind of interesting how, you know, again, I didn't take the clinical route. So what I know of modalities and everything is what I've kind of learned along the way and, you know, readings and trainings that you have to go through. And it's kind of interesting to have all these, you know, DBT, CBT, motivational interviewing, you know, and it seems sometimes very prescriptive, you know, like you gotta do this. And what I find is that at the end of the day, and research shows this, it's about the connection.
Yeah.
It's about the relationship you build with the person. And it's about holding the space for them to tell their story. And
that's
so
true.
I think it's that, like, you just have that moment in that room where they say something to you, and then you ask that probing question of, like, why do you think that happened? Or why do you think you think that way? Or where did that narrative come from?
Yeah.
And then it's like this light goes on in their head of, like, wow, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And then that's where the work starts to happen and the healing starts to happen. And so I think, you know, I think I like that part of it, of just making that connection with people.
Yeah. It definitely feels, you know, reassuring when somebody can, like, give you a little bit of props for their, you know, for their healing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or you know, for their, or starting their journey, or even allowing their journey to happen.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like that's one of my favorite things about doing therapy. But ever since I've been doing it, I really didn't understand, like, the... just kind of the red tape around it too.
Ugh.
You know. You know, so like, you know, there, you know, of course, like, everything else is good and bad, and I really didn't understand how heavy medical it was.
Yeah.
You know, like, I remember having supervision, and my supervisor telling me that, you know, when you diagnose them, you're basically saying that, you know, like, they have a medical problem, mm-hmm. and your therapy is their medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, damn, I don't know why I never thought about it like that way, but I just never did, because it didn't seem like it was so heavy, like, in,
yeah.
you know, like, it's, like, in so much, like, you know, jargon.
Yeah.
But it is.
It absolutely is. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, so that's one thing that I learned about, like, you know, like, doing this whole contractor stuff. It's kind of like, I'm really learning, like, what a private practice takes.
Yeah.
You know.
So, yeah. I think it's a little different, though, from systems versus private practice. I mean, in a private practice, if you choose to bill insurance, it's a little bit more prescriptive in getting that diagnosis and making sure it fits and then making sure you're billing appropriately, et cetera, versus if you're, you know, self-pay, mm-hmm. It's not that it's free for all, but that, you know, coding isn't so important.
Yeah.
Right. And then if you're working for a system, like, you know, I work for a system, and man, it's like, you gotta have the diagnosis, you gotta do the service plan, it's gotta be written a certain way. And sometimes I feel like it's written in a way that's not how people actually think and talk.
Yeah.
You know.
And then, like, you know, the whole baseline thing.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so I'm going to assume this person does this 30% of the time.
Right.
I'm going to assume that I can get them to do it 20% of the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that like, how do you even know you're doing that, right? And I don't know if, like, the where you've been practicing, they use any kind of, like, rating scale. We use a thing called the ACORN. Do you guys do that?
I've never seen that.
So it's this.
But I'm sure somebody does.
Yeah. So it's to rate global distress, right? Yeah. So there's a list of questions, and it's customizable depending on the agency, but the agency has to choose from a specific amount of questions, right?
Yeah.
And so every time the person comes to see you, they fill it out. So that's kind of how you track, like, how they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the questions on ours is, like, sometimes I feel lonely. You know, and so it's like never, sometimes, often, you know, like a Likert scale kind of thing. Yeah. And so I think it's Likert, actually. Yeah, if I remember from my research days. And so that's how they actually data track how someone's doing. Okay. Because God forbid we trust the person to come in and say, yeah, I'm doing a lot better in this area, you know. And at first I was a real hesitant around. I'm like, this is bullshit. This is just another... you know, systems tool to collect data, to aggregate people into categories, you know, of if you got PTSD, this is how well you'll get. If you got depression, boop, boop, all that, you know. And so I had to do a training on it. And once I saw that you could actually then look at somebody's graph.
Yeah.
I kind of am a little bit softer on it, because you could actually then say to the person, you know, you came in here and this is where you were, and then, you know, actually show them where their progress is, you know, as a visual. I mean, I'm not 100% like, yeah, let's do this, but I'm a little bit softer on it now.
Yeah. It's like, I'll accept it.
Yeah.
You know? It makes it a little easier.
Yeah.
But so how do you feel about, like, data in social work? Like, I feel like every time I've had, like, either I read something, had a job or something that's revolving around data and reaching these desirable outcomes, I feel like there's not a true, like, true to term social work way to get desired outcomes.
Yeah.
In like a system, you know what I'm saying? So how do you, so like, you know, in regard, you know, all the numbers. So like, what do you think about, you know, all the numbers in social work and trying to get these, you know, like, you know, create these waves of change?
Here's my thing is I get why it's done, mm-hmm. right? Because it's a science. So yeah. It's a social science, mm-hmm. right? And in any sciences, they're going to do research and collect data and see how things are going. The issue I have with it, and that sometimes gets talked about, is so somebody creates a study.
Yeah.
And somebody creates a questions for the study. Mm-hmm. But who is that somebody?
Yeah.
And how is their implicit bias coming into play around mm-hmm. their research, mm-hmm. right? So they'll say it's evidence-based for all cultures and, you know, categories. And but I go back to who created the study originally, yeah. and it's usually dominant culture normed,
yeah.
right? So you're creating this data in the study based on dominant culture questioning, mm-hmm. and usually dominant culture folks doing the evaluating,
yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. So I wonder, like, how does that skew
yeah.
if it's going to, if the outcome's going to work or not going to work, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I sucked at research class. So I just think of it more in terms of an equity piece of, are we really looking at who are we having creating these studies to create, that are so-called going to create these outcomes of the mm-hmm. things that we're doing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's tough. I feel like I was talking to someone on Twitter about, because they do macro social mm-hmm. work, and before they did therapy, now mm-hmm. in the macro social work, and this is right after we got laid off. So I told her, I was like, you know, I just don't believe in macro social work like yeah. I used to,
mm-hmm.
because I see the things you have to go against,
yeah,
and it's like hard. It's yeah. hard to like it's like if you're trying to sue the NFL,
yeah.
Or fuck the NFL, to a team in the NFL. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I mean, like, so, like, how many lawyers do they have?
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, when you go against these systems and, you know, the brass of these systems, mm-hmm. you know, every system has, you know, a brass, and mm-hmm. you got to go by yourself, and you got to kind of, I mean, like, you might have a team of people like we did, and you got to go against the system, and they can really just pick you apart.
Yeah, I mean, it happened to us, like, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we've lived it.
Yeah,
lived that experience.
So it's not like and that wasn't the first or the last time that something like that could happen.
Yeah.
You know, so my thing is like, how can we reach like these macro desired outcomes?
Yeah, and I think kind of what you're saying is that there's a macro system and the people that run that macro system, mm-hmm. right? So I mean, I think of PSU, and you know, no shade on PSU. I thought it was fine. It got me what I needed, you know.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people talk shit about the social work program, and yeah. I'm like, you know, whatever. I went in there. I needed to get this degree. I got it.
Yeah.
You know, that was my end game.
Yeah.
But I think about the academia of PSU mm-hmm. and the School of Social Work and yeah. how, in one hand, they want to be very, like, progressive and equity-minded and how do we bring people in from the margins.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, I sometimes feel like they don't practice that.
Mm.
You know, I've had a couple weird different experiences since leaving grad school. I had participated in a committee of like culturally competent committee or something like that.
Yeah.
And I often felt, because I was like a community member working in the, you know, field. So I was serving as that. And I felt like those of us that were on that committee were there as like placeholders,
yeah.
like to show, hey, look, we're doing this culturally competent mm-hmm. thing. But I go back to, again, if the rules are made for a certain category of people, unless you dismantle that.
Yeah.
How are you really going to make macro different? It's like yeah. you said, you can sue the NFL or you could sue the county, right? For like, you know, some mm-hmm. sort of harassment or racial harassment, but they'll settle out of court.
Yeah.
You know, because they have a whole team of people who do risk management and say, okay, well, we can afford to settle this case for this amount.
Yeah.
They know that if you go long enough, the person that's suing doesn't have the same resources, so they'll mm-hmm. eventually settle.
Yeah.
And then nobody's done anything wrong. Then there no changes have to be made.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of agree with you. Like, the macro piece, until we look at how does that continued dominant culture norms continue to perpetuate itself in academia, whether it's PSU and the School of Social Work. You know, I heard a lot when I was there about like radical social work, practice radical social work. Yeah. And I was thinking about that today is like, okay, they want you to practice radical social work within their box.
Yeah.
You know,
basically, yeah.
Like, don't talk about certain things, you know, because then you might be seen as too radical.
Or you could talk about something that everybody thinks bad.
Right.
So you could be radical about racism.
Yeah.
But not like local racism.
Right.
Because then now you're climbing up some trees.
Exactly. Yeah.
that might, you know, you start shaking some trees and some stuff might start falling out. So, yeah. So, like, be radical about, you know, like racism, but just not, don't bring it here and talk about our racism.
Right. Yeah. Don't point it out.
Yeah.
Don't point the elephant out in the room.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm the kind of person, and then I'll be honest, this has kind of gotten me into some sticky situations in my past around, like, I'm going to say there's an elephant in this room and it just shit. Are we not going to talk about it?
Yeah.
Not to blame anybody, but why aren't we going to talk about this, you know? And so I've had to learn how to be a little bit more finesse with that.
Yeah.
And because there was a time I was, like, reactive.
Yeah.
And that got me into some situations. I mean, it happened, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think about our experience at the school district, how we were kind of set up to go in. I mean, the team was amazing.
Yeah.
If you looked at our team.
From top to bottom.
Whew. Like, we had some talent. We had some experience. Like, it was like a dream.
Yeah.
You know, of, like, all these different people from different areas of practice, of life experience, were told, go in there and challenge the system around historical racism, around oppression of students of color or marginalized students. Mm-hmm. Like, go in there and push back, right? Yeah. So we did that, but we had no backing.
Yeah.
Right? So that's kind of like the problem you speak of, is that the macro level wants you to do this, but don't point it out in your own house.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I feel like for a little bit, we might have had some backing.
Mm-hmm.
But once, you know, somebody flexes on you.
Yeah.
Or somebody punches you in the face, you know, like, okay. Now it's getting serious, you know, like, you know, so like we thought we had something and now we don't have the protection we thought we had.
Yeah.
So, you know, the people who could, you know, was able to, you know, kind of retreat and not show up for any of us, you know?
Yeah.
Even though they said they were, but, you know, they weren't.
Yeah.
You know, so kind of let things fall and, but that's what, so like me thinking about that is like, if that's at the Portland Public School District, then what happens at like the New York school district?
Right, exactly.
Or, you know, government. You know, like if somebody like a school superintendent could come, not even a superintendent, he didn't care about what he was doing. It was like some director somewhere, if they could care enough to stop what we're trying to do, then like I can only imagine with somebody with more power, a bigger system, like if you're trying to go up against the food industry.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the medical industry or the social work or something like that. Like how you can get crushed.
Right.
You know, but I know there's a person who does macro social work who can sit down and talk to me and explain all the wonderful things going on about it. I get it. But I just, like, just my logical thinking. Like, I just know the stuff that even though we're social workers and we fit and we're supposed to, like, think everything for the good and we're supposed to all, you know, there's still a hierarchy in this work. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, so you might be really ready. Your supervisor might come and say, maybe not right now.
Yeah.
Because it's just too hot.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's definitely happened to me in my past, not only, you know, when we worked at the school district and kind of how we went out there and, you know, we were doing that work and, you know, standing up for what we felt like needed to be for the marginalized, right?
Yeah.
Like, that was part of the legislative funding was historically underserved youth.
Yeah.
So we were like, let's serve these historically underserved youth in a way that's going to make sense to them.
Yeah.
In a way that they haven't been served before, to include them rather than to have them assimilate to the program, right? And I think that's the issue with diversity and inclusion. It's they want assimilation, not inclusion.
Yeah.
And it's a big difference.
Definitely.
You know? And so I think we did that. And you know, in the past, the same kind of thing is like, when you go up against the power structure And even though someone is around you saying, yeah, let's do this, as soon as they go after one or two, then self-preservation comes into play, right? Mm-hmm. And so those of you that, those are the people that were going to have your back or said they'd have your back.
Yeah.
I mean, they got bills. I get it. Yeah. I understand why people retreat back and say, ooh, not now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it, but I get it.
Yeah.
You know, and so.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's kind of what happened is, like you said, we had people that were kind of like having our backs, like go in and do this, we got you, and then weird stuff happened, certain people left, and then, okay, now who's got our back? Well, I don't know, maybe this person, but who do we answer to now? And it was just so fluid, the what was happening above us.
There was consistent inconsistency.
Yes, absolutely, 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 yeah, yeah, for real, yeah.
That was one thing that was consistent about that. Yeah. It was really inconsistent.
Yeah.
Like one week in a meeting, it was like, oh, everything's great. The next week in a meeting, it's like what? Like, did you just tell us? And so, whatever. So when did you know that like social work was going to be it? Like we was like, okay, I'm in my, well, I'm, of course, probably grad school. But like, so I remember you talking about that journey of your old supervisor kind of talking you into it. So like, when did you know like, all right, this is, I'm going all in.
I think it was probably middle of my first year, because I did the 2-year track.
Mm-hmm.
And I met some people and I started doing a little bit more learning. So, you know, I got to say, when I started out in probation, I started out in the very like punitive mindset, lock them up. Throw away the key. You did the crime. You did the time.
I
was bad, bro. I was bad. I feel sometimes like I'm like, damn, I feel bad. I do. I feel bad because that's how I was indoctrinated into that system was, you know, you don't believe anything a kid says. They're always out up to no good. You know, a lot of like terminology that I wouldn't even use today to describe kids who were involved in, you know, gangs and delinquency, you know, even so far as like using person first language now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, back in the day it was like, oh yeah, you know, they're sex offenders or they're gang members, you know, it's like that labeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I started with that pendulum way over there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, slowly as things went through during my criminal justice days, you know, you learn a little bit more, you learn about overrepresentation, you know, because I started in the 90s. When that whole overrepresentation things just started coming around.
Yeah.
And then Multnomah County in the 90s was an agency that was sponsored by the Casey Foundation to deal with overrepresentation. So juvenile justice reform and detention reform and, you know, graduated sanctions and all those things that kind of, oh, let's actually take into account what's happening to the person rather than just let's just lock them up for what they did. So. Yeah. That's when my mind kind of started shifting to more of a, like, a, I would say social work. I didn't have the term for it, but I think that's where it kind of started shifting. And then I think once I was in my first year of grad school and really started reading the things that they have us read, you know, doing the social justice class that we all had to take, you know, really just like realizing there's so much things that connect to why people do what they do.
Yeah.
Right. And treating the whole person rather than just the situation. So I think that's where it started shifting.
Yeah.
For me was like, okay, this makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think too, because I could like apply it to myself a little bit too. Right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah. And I started to learn more about, you know, mental health and mental illness and, you know, what does it mean, you know, to be, to have depression, to have anxiety, what are those things that happen to people when they're experiencing that? And then personally, like my own, you know, living with depression and anxiety, kind of making those connections too. And, you know, it's kind of like the first year psych student that learns a little bit about themselves, you know? So I think that that's where the shift really moved me towards, okay, we really got to do more for the people that don't have anything, you know, and then the income equality. And I remember I took this, I don't know what class it was from the first year, and one of my professors. I can't, what did the article he made us read? But it was basically talking about how, like, the income distribution and how, you know, the haves and have nots, and how this creates systems of oppression, and how it creates, you know, systematic poverty and keeps people in poverty. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, that makes sense. And at the same time, the Occupy movement started. So I even remember sitting in one of my classes and saying, I mean, right now I look back and think that was kind of stupid, but you know, we all say some stupid in class.
Social work
student. Yeah, you know, and saying like, I don't understand the Occupy movement. Like, I didn't. I couldn't wrap my brain around it.
He was on that side.
Yeah, I couldn't. Oh, I mean, like, I got it, but I didn't get it, you know? And then as time went by and I got to learn more about it, and I'm like, okay, now I get it, right? Yeah. Like, I saw past what I thought it was into, like, oh, okay, this is what it really means, is that, yeah, we're all getting fucked by these corporations.
Yeah.
You know? Like, the 1%. Owns 40% or more of our wealth.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's, oh, wow, okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
So then I think I then started shifting into, like, okay, this is what social work is. Yeah. And this is what we can do.
Okay. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that's probably, like, the more you work, the more you kind of get, like, to this, you know, like, you start seeing patterns of things.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking, like, oh, man, like, maybe people don't have options out here. Maybe this is why they're doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think, too, I took the poverty class.
Oh, I took that,
with,
too.
With Lisa Hawash. Did you take that with Lisa?
I took it with her assistant.
Yeah. So that was a really big.
Hold on. It wasn't her assistant. She was also at MSW, too. Yeah. So another professor.
Yeah.
But she was real close with Lisa.
Yeah. So I think that opened my eyes, too, a lot, was around, especially around houselessness and, you know, the impact of that, and how we don't, I mean, we really just, like, marginalize that portion of our population and create this myth of that they, you know, they deserve it for some reason because they're on, you know, addicted to drugs, or, you know, they've had criminal histories, and, you know, so we the messaging in society, in general society, is that there's some sort of choice. And then you learn about, you know, the working poor.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Like, I think you actually posted that article about jobs and the poverty. Yeah. And I was reading that the other day, and, like, that just reminded me of, like, it isn't about just get a job, because you could work three jobs and still not be able to afford housing.
Yeah,
especially
true.
Here in this area, right? We're seeing it. We've been seeing it over the last, you know, 10 years.
Yeah.
The housing crisis and gentrification and all the impact. So I don't know if that answered your question, how I got deep into social work.
It does. You know, I think that the powers that be are able to get that lie off is because of our insecurities.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, we want to believe that, hey, if I do everything right, I will never experience those kind of hardships.
Yeah.
But at the same time, so I feel like you're telling yourself, like, yeah, that person did mess up.
Yeah.
I don't mess up. So I will never be in that position.
Yeah.
But it's looking, I mean, for stretch way stuff's going, it's looking like anybody can.
Yeah. I mean, the middle class is not the middle class anymore. Yeah. Like, they're living paycheck to paycheck. We're living, we're the middle class, right?
Yeah.
I'm, you know, paycheck to paycheck, right? Like, so one bad medical bill.
Yeah.
Because the way healthcare is, right? Yeah, I got insurance, but those bitches could deny anything. You know?
True.
Pre-existing condition. Sorry, we're not going to cover it. Yeah. You know, like, private healthcare is, in my opinion, terrible. Like, when you're making profit on people's illnesses, come on.
Yeah.
Do you really want them to get better? You know, so, I mean,
yeah,
I feel like what you said, I think that it's a myth that's sold to us that if we just do all these things,
it will never happen.
It'll never happen to you, right? So if you just follow this path, everything will be roses and sunshines and unicorns.
So you judging that person is like, you're reassuring, oh, it'll never happen to me, you know? So you are a person that holds a lot of, like, titles. You have LCSW.
I do have an LCSW.
So I want to ask about that, something about that later.
Okay.
But you're also, like, a trauma-informed specialist.
Well, I mean, I guess. I'm not a specialist. I've been trained to provide trauma-informed care trainings.
Okay.
So that's how I like to say it.
I have a few questions about that. But one of them is, like, kind of deep. I don't know. If you don't want to go there, you got to go there. But what do you think the link between race and trauma? Like, how do you, what's your view on that?
Oppression is trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I do my trainings, so it's kind of interesting. So I've been doing trainings now for about 3 years. I think I was trained 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And so immediately I saw the link of oppression and racism is a form of trauma. Mm-hmm. Historical trauma, racism is trauma, right? Yeah. And the epigenetics of it, right? So that shit's passed down whether today you're experiencing the trauma or not, mm-hmm. right? So if you look at African Americans in our country and slavery and that trauma that has never been healed mm-hmm. and isn't even really acknowledged still.
Yeah.
Right? There's never been an apology. Mm-hmm. So every day, people who look like you and who look like my husband are experiencing that trauma, whether they know it or not, right? Yeah. And you don't ever get a break from the trauma, mm-hmm. right? So I absolutely include this piece in my trainings. I think sometimes it's kind of interesting. I did one recently in Astoria. Mm. Very small community, mm-hmm. pretty white.
Yeah.
And I was kind of hitting on that piece. And you notice people in the room, you know, kind of shifting. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever really said anything, yeah. but I could tell the body language of people when I was really talking about, like, if you're working with people of color, like, this is a trauma that they live with every single day that yeah. gets reactivated by the racism that occurs in our society, mm-hmm. right? And especially now.
Yeah.
I mean, hate crimes are up, 116%, I think, the last thing I read, mm-hmm. since the orange buffoon was, you know, brought into office. Sorry, I don't like him. I don't know, you can edit that out if you want, but I think you know I'm pretty clear on my stance.
Yeah, I got you.
So that there was a re-traumatization every day of people of color, especially African Americans in our mm-hmm. community. Because, you know, look at the Black Lives Matter movement, right?
Yeah.
People try to demonize that. People have tried to say it's the fucking government has tried to say it's a terrorist group.
Yeah.
So how does that feel of a person who is black that is like, wow, you're trying to call me a terrorist just because I'm trying to bring a movement and yeah. bring awareness? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 100% racism is trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to deal with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's true. So growing up, did you ever like experience any of that stuff growing up where you grew up?
You know, it's kind of interesting. So I'm biracial. My mother's white. My father's Mexican-American. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I grew up in a very small community. The interesting thing is I think because I was popular, it was always like joking to me, you know, like, you know, my friends or whatever would be use kind of derogatory terms for Mexicans towards me yeah. in a joking manner. And yeah. at the time, you know, I don't know any different, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember the first time I think I realized that I was Mexican, right? Yeah. For all intents and purposes. Now I kind of like, sometimes identify as mixed, sometimes I say Latina, you know, I'm kind of like on the fence of how I wanna, yeah. because I'm light skinned. So a lot yeah. of people read me as white,
yeah.
right? And so, I remember being, I don't know, I was like grade school age, and my uncle, who was in the Navy, had come home for a visit,
mm-hmm.
and he told me a joke,
mm-hmm.
and the joke was a racist joke
mm-hmm.
about being Mexican.
Yeah.
I'll just say it involved a duck and a skunk.
Yeah.
And the duck was a duck, and because the skunk was not black or white, then it was Mexican, right? He told that joke
yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
Right? And so I was like, I can remember that to this day. And I'm 46 years old.
Yeah.
And I can remember to this day thinking to myself, well, what does that mean about me?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then, again, because I grew up in my white family, a lot of my white family would say things derogatory towards Mexicans, but then say to me, but not your dad, Tori. He was one of the good ones.
Yeah.
Right. And then fast forward to social work school and learning about internalized depression mm-hmm. and that I was like, oh, OK, now, oh, I get why I felt like weird within my own family.
Yeah.
Right. Again, I'm light skinned, but of my family, I'm darker. Right. Yeah. My brother's blonde hair, blue eyes. So he looks very much like my mom. I have more of my dad's features. I, you know, would get really tan in the summer. One of my brother's friends asked one time if I was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of those things I don't think I knew at the time.
Yeah.
But now I know as an adult after learning, mm-hmm. you know. So I had a basketball coach would joke about me and say I shoot like the Mexican. I don't know what that meant. What does that mean? See, your face is like, it's like, what does that, what did that mean?
I don't know.
You know, and because I was a, you know, I was a good kid. I was, you know, I was popular. I played sports. I don't think I internalized it as racism, but yeah. that's what it was.
Yeah.
Right.
100%.
You know, so it was an interesting journey kind of growing up in that small town, knowing that I was. You know, I was, you know, called Mexican. I was, you know, referred to that because I of everyone else. I mean, I think we had one friend in the same grade. She was Asian, and then we had one kid who came for like a couple years. Black kid came up from California, lived mm-hmm. with his aunt, and then another girl. She was black. She only stayed there for like a year. Well, she was actually part of a cult, but that's a whole nother story.
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty interesting.
So she probably won't stay.
Yeah, like, no, they took her out. They let her come to public school, and that was, as soon as that happened, they moved her out. And, but she got out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's, you know, we're friends on Facebook now, okay. and I actually got to see her at my reunion. Like, it was really cool to, like, nice. See her. Yeah, yeah, she was a good friend of ours, and so yeah, you know, I mean, being different mm-hmm. in a very white town, you know you're different.
Yeah.
Right? And then I move and leave there, and then I'm not that much different.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I, like I said, people read me as white mostly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. How, do you ever like get a chance to like use that as like to your benefit to help someone?
Oh,
else?
I think I probably do it all the time, and I don't know it. Right. Yeah. I know I have passing privilege. You know, I know when I'm driving, I'm probably less likely to get pulled over mm-hmm. because, you know, if they see me driving, they're going to think I'm a white lady.
Mm.
You know, I feel like if anything, I probably get discriminated against because I look like what a lesbian looks like. Mm-hmm. I'm just keeping it real, right? Yeah. Like the stereotypical lesbian, mm-hmm. and I'm not.
Yeah,
you know. So I feel like I would probably get targeted more for that than I would for looking Latina.
Yeah,
you know. So I do think that there's been times. For example, my husband and I were driving to Idaho mm-hmm. through Idaho to get to Utah.
And, oh my God!
I know. Yeah. And so we were driving, and I was playing football, and so we were going to Salt Lake for a game for the weekend. And so we just get across the border of Idaho into Idaho, and there's a rest area like right when you get into Idaho.
Yeah.
And my husband had to go to the bathroom real bad, and so it's like I'm trying to get there, and so I pull off, and this fucking state trooper comes in behind me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And lights us up. Well, at the time, he didn't see, you know, he couldn't see me. So obviously he ran my plates.
Yeah.
And my last name's Lopez.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, then his, you know, spidey senses are like, oh, Washington plate, driving through Idaho, last name Lopez, black male passenger.
Yeah.
So I just pull into the parking spot and he, you know, him and his partner get out the car. And my husband, he's got to go pee bad. Like, my husband got a small bladder. Yeah. So he's, like, trying to get into the bathroom. And the cop's like, no, come back here. And my husband's also hearing impaired.
Yeah.
So.
Didn't hear him.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, I was like, hey, babe. You know, so he heard me. And so he came back. And so they just was interrogating me. Like, where are you going? How long are you going to be gone? They finally let him go to the bathroom while they, you know, run. They took his license and everything. And, like, they just kept questioning. You know, the tactic they do, they just keep asking the same question over and over in different ways to see if they'll trip you up, right?
Yeah.
And then he goes into, like, you don't got any drugs in the car, do you? And I'm like, why would I have drugs in the, you know, like, what even made you think? And then it was like, oh, last name Lopez, black male passenger, out-of-state license, going to Utah only for the weekend.
Yeah.
Because I said, oh, we're going to Salt Lake. Well, when you coming home, I said, Sunday, you're only going for the weekend? So in his head, oh, that's a drug run, right? You don't have drugs in the car. So at this point, I'm like, no. And he's like, well, if we bring the dog out, are you going to, you know,
speed off?
Is it going to, you know, is it going to hit on anything? Yeah. And I said, I don't think that that would be smart of me, considering what I do for a living. At the time, I was a probation officer. So yeah. I dropped that privilege. I said, I'm a probation officer. Immediately, his attitude changed. Oh, okay, yeah, you know, let me just, you know, run these licenses. I'll get you out of here.
Yeah.
So I think, one, that gave me privilege. My light skin probably gave me some privilege.
Yeah.
Once he realized I wasn't some, you know, drug mule,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
What he didn't know is I did have some cannabis in the car. It's medicinal only.
I'm sure he will let you go.
Yeah, yeah.
I had an old coworker who tried to name drop my superintendent at the facility when he got pulled over, and he found out, and he got a nice stern talking to.
Yeah, yeah. I would never drop names, but I did drop the probation officer. Yeah. You know, why would I do that?
Yeah. You know, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah,
yeah. So so more trauma.
More trauma. Bring it.
So, do you ever like? I mean, I know we've experienced workplace trauma,
mm-hmm.
but is that part of like your practice? You know, do you like provide like some kind of like assistance with that, or like kind of like ways to get out of that? Because I'm not gonna lie, when we got laid off, like June,
mm-hmm.
I was a mess.
Oh, I bet.
You know,
yeah, just I bet,
because so many things had to change. You know, like it wasn't. I really didn't have, like, you know, work. So I got, like, the male ego telling me that you ain't working.
Mm-hmm.
Your wife's working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we got to change our whole routine because, you know, I would drop her off at work, then I would go to work, and mm-hmm. then all that stuff. And then, you know, just, like, the insecurities, like, you know, having to look for a job.
Yeah.
You know, and then not wanting to take any job.
Right.
You know, really trying to wait for, you know, the right opportunity to show up. And so I just was really, like, I really was, like, just tore up, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I never experienced that before. I've never been laid off before.
Oh, you know? Okay. Yeah.
You know, I've never been. So, like, so really just, especially with so much shit I got to, like, do.
Yeah.
If it was just me by myself, I'm like, that sucks, but whatever. But,
right.
You know, you just, you know, like, and it wasn't going to be my forever job, but just when, you know, when shit just kind of happens, and then the way it happened, I feel like I got laid off, like, 5 times. I feel like, because, like, when we first found out, that was one. The second time was when, like, I think the second time was when my school found out. That was two. So that was, like, going through it all over again. The last time, or the third time, is when I got, like a letter 5 months later saying I was getting laid off.
Oh, so they finally give you a letter.
Yeah, they finally gave me a letter, okay. You know what I'm saying? Then after that, it was, you know, me talking to my old boss and him saying that, oh, we didn't have to lay anybody off.
Oh, you man.
Know? And then I finally got, like, a cancellation of insurance.
Oh,
so it was like a long just process.
Yeah.
Just like me, just,
it's like re-traumatization every time.
You know, so basically, I just wanted to say, like, how does one, like, kind of like how have you gotten, like, out of, like, those kind of slumps?
Wow, that's, I mean,
if you have,
I had a really big slump. Let's just say, My job with the county didn't end on my terms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to say that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of things that led up to that, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'll just keep it real. People could Google me and find out. So
yeah.
I ended up getting fired from the job.
Okay.
But prior to that, myself and several employees of color were really trying to push to deal with racism against employees of color, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we had done, you know, gotten some statistics around disciplines and employees of color being 3 times as likely to be disciplined for something that the same thing the white employee, you mm-hmm. know? So same kind of statistical things playing out, right? And so we were really trying to push and say, okay, we just want this to be talked about.
Yeah.
And we want to change the system to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you call it out,
mm.
you make yourself a target.
Yeah.
And I will admit, during that time, I was very reactive. I was not, I currently have a meditation and mindfulness practice,
yeah.
and I did so because of that trauma that I experienced. So I can look back and say, oh, you know, things I could have done differently. Would it ended the same? Probably.
Yeah.
Because I was part of people saying we're not doing well by our employees of color and you're being racist.
Yeah.
You know, people don't like to be called racist when they're being racist.
Yeah.
You know, so I absolutely know what that trauma feels like of losing a job, not knowing. And this was at my last year of grad school. Again, remember I said that I was had this great plan of how I was going to use this degree and, you know, and stay in the field and blah, blah, blah. That didn't happen. And I remember just being, you know, completely depressed by it, you know, like in a huge deep depression, because here I was, like, just finished grad school, and I had made up in my mind that, oh, if you get fired, you're never going to get another job, and you tell yourself these stories that are not true, right? But you believe them, because you're in that traumatic space, and, you know, for me, how did I heal? I mean, part of it was, you know, telling the story, right? Being in therapy, telling the story in therapy, you know, and just going to therapy every week and crying on the therapist couch, you know, and and surrounding myself with people who believed in what, you know, believed my story, believed what happened was wrong, you know. Again, I took a meditation at that point, you know, and just learned how to let things go. I mean, I'm not like 100% great at it, but I think it's really about getting help when you need it, you know, and going to therapy, finding a good therapy that therapist that fits. Okay. I think that's sometimes hard. I mean, especially if you're a person of color.
Yeah.
You know, my therapist was a white male. He was a Buddhist though, so I felt like, you know,
he had some kind of,
I mean, I felt like he understood, like he really, he did seem like he empathized with my situation and agreed a lot with me around racism and racist issues and systematic racism. And so, you know, I think it's that it's, just remembering your own worth. And I think that's what's really hard in times like that, is that remembering that the skills that you have, they didn't take those away, right?
Yeah.
So, like, when you got laid off or, you know, I mean, I got out before the layoff happened.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as we were told the first time, I'm like, applications going out.
Well, only stayed because I had an Atlanta conference I was going to.
Hey, that was smart. I hadn't signed up for any conferences, so I had no reason to stick around. Hey,
I'm going to this conference.
Yeah.
In Atlanta. I don't care.
No, that was smart. I mean, you got a trip to Atlanta out of it. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's you know, a number of things of just remembering that whatever happens to you in those kind of situations, they can't take away who you are and what you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to just find people that help you remind you of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I had to do. You know, it was like I just had to make sure I surrounded myself with people who believed my story, who supported me, who, you know, believed in what I could do. And, you know, I mean, ultimately I got a job like in August of that year.
Yeah.
So I finished grad school in June, you know, got a job right away, you know, and I've been employed ever since.
Yeah.
You know, so, and, but there's times like, you know, that that trauma still exists, you know, someone will say something or something will happen and it gets reactivated. And that's what trauma, that's what happens in trauma, right?
Yeah.
So it lives in your amygdala.
Yeah.
In your threat center of your brain. And so certain things will happen that will kind of trigger that. And I know even in being, you know, in the different jobs I've had, being a little bit more, do I want to say something to challenge the status quo?
Yeah.
Because I have that experience of what had happened to me when I did that. And so, you know, is this the right time to say it? Or, you know, I don't want to be that person that steps out on the limb and says, okay, I'll say it, but you guys back me up, because what happened, because of self-preservation, people retreated back to their protection space, you know? So people get into survival mode. They do what they can do to survive. So, I don't know, therapy. Take care of yourself, you know, surround yourself with people that love you.
Yeah.
You know, that really, that you're authentic people, right?
Mm.
You know, the people that you know will accept you for all your foibles and your warts and your, you know, your farts and everything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the people that you don't have to be anything but who you are.
Yeah.
You know, that's what, for me, helped anyway.
Yeah. That's good. That's good to know. I actually had to shut somebody down last weekend.
Oh.
Because part of the traumatization is everybody asking you, what are you going to do? Or what are you doing now? Or what, you know, so I think people mean well. But when you lose a job and you talk about like your current job or your next job or whatever, like you just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So are people actually, well, how's work? You know, it's like you just don't want to do it. So like, so after a while, I just kind of got tired of it. So last week, I was at the Dallas and one of my wife's family friend asked me, I heard you got a new job, which I did, you know, and she kind of asked me about it. Now this job that I got, that's like probably like, you know, one of my main jobs. It's like it's not a master's level job, so me telling people about it, it's not like cool. So I don't like telling people about it. It's a job just to kind of get, you know, some revenue, and I just had to tell her, you know, I just don't like talking about it.
Yeah,
I just don't want to.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and plus I see you how many times a year?
Yeah,
I don't want to talk about it.
Right,
you know.
Fine. Yeah, like drawing that boundary.
Yeah,
totally drawing that boundary.
And I was trying to explain it, but I just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So. You know, and I think that's the, you know, if we go back to what matters in society based on a dominant culture norm is what job do you have?
Yeah.
What level of job do you have? Yeah. Right. We put this value on if it's not a master's level job and you have a master's degree. Oh, well, you're not as valuable. Yeah. Anymore.
I get you know? Asked that a lot. Like at that job, it's like, why do you have this job? You have a master's degree. And I was like, I need a paycheck.
Yeah, you know, like, exactly. Like, why you got this job? Because you need a paycheck, you know?
But yeah, you know, like it pays all right and I just need a job. So yeah, you know, like I feel like, yeah, like one of the co-owners of Stupid Burger, he's you know, childhood friend of mine. Mm-hmm. He put it like a status on Facebook and was like, why do people ask how's business as like a talking prompt?
Yeah.
You know, so like why do we do that?
Yeah.
You know? Or like why do we ask how's it going?
Yeah.
Cause are you ready for
exactly.
You know, like if I say, oh, this is really how it's going, if I laid everything out for you, you ready to kind of take that in?
People ain't ready for that.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So yeah, I feel like these norms that we got, it's just like if I went through my whole life and never got laid off, you know. I wouldn't think twice about it. I would always ask somebody,
of course,
hey, how's the job?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But now since I've been through this, I know that sometimes that's not cool.
Yeah.
It's just not
exactly.
Cool, you know?
Yeah.
Or asking someone, you know, that might have been, it's just like, there's this stuff that like I never would think about, you know, it's like asking someone, oh, how's this project going? Or, you know, or you were pregnant last time I seen you, how's the baby?
Mm-hmm.
Say it's like
right?
that. You never know what happened during that pregnancy.
Exactly.
You know? So like, yeah, we do it out of like, you know, just like kind of like gullible curiosity, I guess. You really just want to know, and you assume that everything happens good in life,
right? Yeah, you know? And the social norm of, like you said, how you doing? How you been? And that's a rhetorical question most of the time, because people don't want to hear how you really been.
Yeah,
and people ask me like in times when how you doing, and I've literally said to them, do you want to know the truth or do you want me to just tell you I'm fine and move on? Like, I will call them on it. And they get a little uncomfortable, but I'm like, you know, be aware. Like, when you're asking someone how are they, they may not be that great.
Yeah, they might be.
You know? And then the whole job thing, you know, it's like this, almost like this capitalistic patriarchal norm of like, what job do you do, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to a dinner party or a party or something, right? What are the top three questions people are going to ask you?
Yeah, what do you do?
What do you do for a living?
Yeah.
Are you married? Do you have kids?
Yeah.
Right? Like, one, the kid question, well, maybe people don't want to have kids.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe something happened to their kids. Mm-hmm. Right? The job question, why does it matter? Because then you tell them, and then that's followed by the,
oh, this is what I do.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's like a status thing, right?
Yeah.
And I recently had an experience where we at my place where I'm working now is we have an intern. And so they brought the person in to introduce me, you know, and we were, you know, doing the blah, blah, blahs, the niceties, you know, this is what I've done, this is what I do, you know. And so I looked at her and I said, what do you do that makes you happy? And she was like, because she expected the, you know, where have you worked before, you know, whatever. And she was taken aback by it because I decided, and I think it was from like a similar post someone else had put and, you know, those kind of things of like, that's going to be my thing. I'm going to ask people, what do you do that makes you happy?
Yeah.
Because
Most people can't. I know I can't answer that.
Because it's not in our brain.
Yeah.
Because our brain is hardwired for negativity, right? So if I asked you what's everything's wrong with you, you'd be like, be able to rattle, you know, five things off that's been bad for your week.
Mm-hmm.
But if I asked you, tell me what's made you happy this week.
Yeah.
It would be like, oh, shit, I don't know. What has made me happy?
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
That's true.
But from a mindfulness technique, the only way that you can wire that brain to go to that way is by doing that. Mm. So I've decided that's going to be my new thing.
Yeah.
What do you do that makes you happy?
I like that. I like that for real. Because I've been asked that question a few times. Just like, you know, and it's like, I don't really know. Right now, you know, did I ever know? At a time, collecting toys made me happy, as you can see.
Yeah, well, you got a sweet collection, man.
That's a good one. Do you ever like look in your intern's eyes when like people are ranting about like how bad work is and see them get scared?
Yeah,
I love that. When interns are like, oh, that's happening. I was like, oh no, don't worry. This place is nice. Don't worry. You'll be fine. You'll be good.
Don't worry about it. You'll be fine.
Interns. Just like, oh, this place isn't great.
Yeah.
Like,
but isn't that the norm, the cultural norm of any workplace, even if you're a new employee, right?
Yeah, you're like, you're scared. Like, what?
Like, it's always interesting how, like, when you start a new job and how, like, the different people come around to tell you the different stories, you know, of that, like, about that person and, oh, you know.
Yeah.
And the ways that they do it, too, right? Some are very, like, kind of covert in how they do it. And some people are, like, totally direct, like, you watch out for Chris. Like, you know. Don't talk to him about anything personal because, you know, it'll get around. You know, kind of interesting. And since I left grad school, shit, I've had like, I don't know, five different jobs.
Mm.
Like I was in probation from 1995 to 2013.
Yeah.
I was raised by a baby boomer. So the concept is you get a job with benefits and retirement and you stay there till you retire.
Boom.
Right? Yeah. Like that was the mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So leaving grad school, that has been weird for me to change jobs so much.
Yeah.
Because in my narrative of my family of origin bullshit is you have to stay in a job until you retire.
Yeah.
And what I've then now found out that what the average is 2 years for a social worker.
Mm, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Like you may go into another social work job.
Yeah.
But the average stay is about two years. So you're 2 years here, 2 years there.
Yeah.
So I've had like five different jobs.
I've had a lot,
that new employee experience has been kind of an interesting journey.
I've had a lot too. I've probably been offered like 15.
Yeah.
But had about maybe like five.
Yeah.
No, well, like three full-time jobs. And then like the rest is part-time, contracts, on call.
Yeah.
You know, so like three and three.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. And that was one thing that was fucking with me too. Because when I got out of grad school, I was like hand picking jobs.
Yeah.
And then this time around, it was like, it wasn't as fruitful. It wasn't as fast. So that was when I was like, oh shit, did I waste my goddamn time with the fucking school district? But anyway.
Yeah. It did feel like a bit of a waste.
It was a waste of my time.
I mean, I look back and I'm like, I mean, I would say
most definitely. Like there was some I wouldn't even give it any kind of plug. That place.
Oh no, I would say don't work for. Yeah, I would not. Could not in good conscience say, yeah, you should try working there.
Nah.
I couldn't. Yeah. Now I met some great teachers in this one of the schools I was at. I met some great teachers, people I'm friends with now still. So that's been nice. The kids, the times I had with the kids there, like that was great. Especially because my past experience with the teenagers was in a punitive setting, right? Yeah.
So to be that
quote good guy, you know, of like, I am here to help you.
Somebody to speak.
I am not your disciplinarian.
Yeah.
That is the principal's job. You're not in trouble if you come to my office, you know? And so just being able to have that connection with that was pretty sweet.
That was nice.
That was nice. But as far as like, you know, any working for that system, nah.
It's hard. It's hard to navigate.
Yeah,
that's the hardest system ever. Because it's so heavy with like licensure.
Yeah,
like that's one of the in social work professions, if you have an LCSW, you know, well, like besides a clinic, like a clinic, you kind of have to have LCSW to be a supervisor. But anything else is kind of like you can move your way up,
right?
You
know, exactly.
But school district is like it's heavy with licensure.
Yeah.
Like you gotta be licensed to be.
Yeah, and specific license, right? Yeah. So even like me with my L, I couldn't get any kind of supervisor because you had to have an admin license, right? Or you had to have a school social worker L versus a clinical L.
I refused to get that. I was like, I'm not getting that.
I thought about it for a minute because I could have done all the backdoor stuff that they didn't tell you could do in grad school.
Yeah.
So, I mean, tip to grad school kids.
Yeah. It's easier to get it if you don't take the school social
track. You can get it afterwards. Yeah. You just got to do some paperwork.
Yeah.
They don't want you to know that, but pro tip here, heard it here, right?
Yeah.
So I thought about it, but then I thought, I got to pay for a whole other test.
Mm-hmm.
I got to pay for that license.
And you gotta get some CEUs on top of it.
No, thanks. No, thanks.
Yeah. I was good. I was like, I'm all right. I'm okay. So, but I had a friend that asked me a question. Not a friend, a person I follow on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we follow each other. He's trying to get into therapy. And he asked me this question. Well, what is the difference between an LPC and an LCSW?
Mm.
Now, I told him from my little bit of knowledge, I was like, well, it's usually like, it's the same thing, kind of, but it's just different, like, just different trainings, different schools.
Pretty much that's
it. You know, so.
Yeah.
But do you have, like, a more in-depth LPC, LCSW breakdown?
No, I would say it's just that. It's just different philosophies in how you learn.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, and this may be my bias because I am a social worker, I feel the LCSW process is more robust. It opens you up to a lot of different things other than just clinical counseling, right?
Yeah.
Like you could get your LCSW and really not ever do hard clinical, like one-on-one therapy. Like you could be a case manager. You could be a social worker that doesn't do therapy, one-on-one therapy, and you still get your clinical license, mm-hmm. right? So I feel like it opens your, you know, what you see and how you see the people that you work with differently. Whereas the licensed practicing counselor, it's about that counseling, right? I think the benefit of the LPC is if you do that program, they really train you to do that therapy. Like you go and you be a therapist. And whereas I don't feel like, and I didn't take clinical track, but I don't know many people that did that. They actually went and were like a intern therapist.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas the counseling program, they require you to be a intern therapist. Yeah. Right. They really set you up for, if you wanted to just leave there and do a private practice, like you can go into a private practice.
That's true.
They train you to how to become a therapist.
Yeah.
Which I think that's the advantage of that, if that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I at one time thought, well, what if I, you know, did a private practice? I mean, I didn't know how to build one. They didn't teach that in social work school. And in fact, I feel like social work school, it's almost like they have this bias against it of becoming a private practitioner.
Some people,
You know, it was like this... It was like this forbidden thing you don't talk about going and doing because you're going to make money, right?
Yeah.
And it felt like this weird, almost like you got to take a vow of poverty if you're going to go into social work, right? Like, oh, we don't get into this with the money, which I think is bullshit and a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think we need to change that
narrative.
I see a lot of social workers get paid.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I see a lot of them that's cash and checks.
Right.
You
know? And I think that we need to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Right?
You definitely do. I've had a few, like, since I started, like, my profile on Instagram, a few people, like, kind of, you know, get in my inbox. I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what you're trying to preach, but this is not what social work is. I was like, damn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's been a while, but when I first, started getting, like, a little bit of traction.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of like questions and people like questioning.
Like, because you were trying to make money doing it?
Well, just really like, just really preaching, you know, like, you know, it's okay to get paid.
Oh, cool. You know, oh, that's cool.
Now, it's not my main point, but that is a point that I like to make. It's like, you know, if there's a social worker out here who's going to get paid $10,000 to go speak, then they should.
Yeah.
Then that's on them.
Yeah.
It's nothing wrong with that.
Right. You
know? Step your game up and go get that.
I fucking agree with you. That's why I think that we should not limit our worth. Right. Yeah. But I think there is a social work school perspective
mm-hmm.
that kind of creates that.
But then professors like live in mansions and
right. That's, you know, and that's the thing that pissed me off the most.
That kind of stuff.
Was they're standing in class telling us, oh, you know, you're not gonna make a whole lot and do. And I'm thinking, well, I know where you live.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, yeah, so yeah,
professors get it. You know,
yeah.
they get it. Book writers get it.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, but I feel like they don't really like separate. Like, you can serve the community
mm-hmm.
and still have like a decent living.
Absolutely. And you should be able to have yeah. a decent living.
That's true.
Doing your trade, right?
Yeah.
This is very, I don't want to say sacred work, but you know, this is very, like, what we do is real and it's intense.
Yeah.
And we, whether you're a therapist or a case manager or a unit staff at a psych unit,
mm-hmm.
you know, wherever you're doing social work, you're coming into contact with people and you're working your emotions all day long and you're working your empathy.
Yeah.
You know, your ability to have that empathy and hold space for people is tiring and mm-hmm. it's emotionally tiring. Yeah, we're not building things and being physically, you know, physical with our work, but the emotional toll
yeah.
it takes and the and what happens. I don't know if you saw recently there were two folks that committed suicide that were
that are mental health advocates.
So because this work is real.
Yeah.
Like it's I remember recently having a client and the story, the trauma story that I heard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in my top five.
Yeah, bad.
Like, it just was like, I'm just sitting there in the room trying to hold that space. And in my head, I thought, is it going to stop?
Yeah.
Like, I had that thought, like, when is it going to stop?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one story after the other. And that was one of the first times that I'm sitting in this room and I'm, like, trying not to cry.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I can't cry.
Yeah.
I can't cry.
Yeah.
But holy shit, people are horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
True.
What people do to other people,
mm-hmm.
even to your own family.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so that emotional toll should be worth
yeah.
money.
Yeah.
Right?
You got to hold it.
Yeah.
You know, like that vicarious trauma.
Mm-hmm.
What's the other one? What the fuck is the other one? It's vicarious trauma. Then it's the other one. There's the one like where you share the trauma with somebody.
So the interesting thing about vicarious trauma is that's kind of going away because the term vicarious trauma makes it seem as if it's their fault that you're traumatized.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah. So okay. What I've heard recently is moving more towards secondary traumatic stress.
Okay.
Because we're sharing this, mm-hmm. right? You didn't come in here and purposely traumatize me,
yeah, just
right?
Boom.
Like, I didn't yeah. come in here without my own shit, and then you just say, oh, here, take my stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So, that secondary traumatic stress, the compassion fatigue.
Yeah, the other one I was thinking about was trauma bonding.
Yeah, trauma bonding, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we do that as workers, right? Because we tell these stories to each other like, oh, you're not going to believe what happened, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe the story that I just heard.
Yep, and then you're at the bar getting another shot.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right, you know? And I think that was one part about, like, the other part of, going through with the workplace trauma is that I didn't have a team to like debrief with.
Yeah.
So like, you know, we started meeting less at work,
mm-hmm.
and then towards the end of the year, we didn't meet at all.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And then like, I got the job doing contract work and, I'm in the field by myself. So there's nobody like to come, like come back to the office and like chill with. And then I don't know if they kick it like I kick it. So I don't want to be like, hey, let's go get, you know, a few some rounds. And
it's right.
Because like, it was like people that did DNA work and stuff.
Yeah.
So I just didn't want to like put that kind of spirit in the building.
Exactly.
You know, so I kind of just kept to myself. Not saying that's a huge part of my persona.
Right.
But, you know, going out and hanging out, I like to do that.
Right.
You know? So I just felt alone.
Yeah.
You know, it felt real.
It's very isolating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like this really like, you know, just.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm kind of experiencing a little bit of that where I'm at now because I'm in a primary care clinic and I'm the therapist for the clinic, right?
Yeah.
So I don't have other therapists that work with me.
Mm.
And I haven't thankfully, I have my own office. I do like that piece because yeah. I can just shut the door and, you know, do my own thing at lunch and, you know. But I do miss that ability to have a coworker to be like, you know, oh, hey, this happened. I mean, I do have, there's a what they call behavioral health consultant who I've, you know, connected with. And so her and I have kind of, you know, been able to share and trauma bond. And after I had that one experience, like I had one more client left for the day. And I was like, I got to go discharge some of this before I go to the next client because I'm not going to have anything for that next client, right? And that's one of the things that I think is fucked up about the system of care of, you know, you have 53-minute sessions and then you get like maybe 5 minutes in between your next set, the productivity model, right? Yeah. Of you got to see person back to back to back to back. So that secondary traumatic stress that you're experiencing in the room, how does that get discharged when you got to go right into the next story, right into the next trauma? And so having someone is, I think this is important, or having somewhere outside of that, whether it's a consultation group or just a group of people that you know that you can go to and hang out and they don't have to explain, right? I think that's why a lot of times we end up, especially in social services, we end up connecting with people in social services, right? Because
they can relate.
We don't have to explain that,
right?
We don't have to explain that experience that we have in the work that we do. It's just understood, you know? So,
Tell me about how your podcast is going.
Oh, my podcast is going. It's going good. I mean, it's pretty low key. I call it my hobby podcast right now. It's pretty low key. We don't really advertise anywhere. I mean, you mentioned it on one of yours. Thank you. Appreciate that. So it's called What Are You Bringing to the Table? And so it's me and my friend Sylvia. She actually, I worked with her in probation work. So I know her from criminal justice. She is a, I think she has a counseling degree. I think that's what her master's is in. And so, you know, we were just sitting around one day. Like I said, just we would, when we would hang out, we would just talk about news stories. And we'd be like, did you see that story about so-and-so? Yeah, like whatever it was about, whether it was politics, was about some weird, you know, event or a murder or whatever, right? Yeah. And we would just go off, like just talking about it. And so we decided to do the podcast. And, you know, like, what are we going to talk about? And you know, what were we going to name it? And I was like, well, what do you bring to the table? You know, and so what are you bringing to the table today, right? So we just, you know, we share, we bring our, the stories, you know, we take, like, I just take them from my news feed, you know, on social media and like, oh, I'll save that one. I'll save that one. Sometimes they're just funny, weird stories, you know, like a giant crocodile or something like that, you know, or the meth crocodiles down south. And sometimes they're serious stuff. You know, we do do a, we do a lot around like social justice issues and we talk about the, you know, social justice and the differential treatment of people of color in the justice system. And, you know, last episode or this upcoming episode that's going to drop on Friday, we talked about the Dallas police officer that for once a police officer convicted of killing a black man. You know, like what? I mean, she only got 10 years though. So she'll be out in probably seven. So, you know, we talked about that story and how, you know, here it was, that finally someone got convicted for it, you know, and like, you know, just different things like that. Sometimes, you know, we'll get heated between the two of us. I mean,
I've heard a couple of those.
We're both pretty liberal. I'm like on the way end of the liberal spectrum, you know, like she's a little bit more towards the centers on things. And so, yeah, we'll get in our own little like heated discussion over stuff. And so it's kind of fun that way, you know, we don't agree on everything. So we get a little heated, you know, and it's fun. It's, you know, I don't know if it'll lead to anything, but it's kind of like my self-care. Somebody asked me, what do you do for self-care one time? And I said, you know, I started this podcast and that's kind of my self-care because I don't really come at it as like I'm the social worker doing this podcast. I mean, I do mention I'm a social worker and that there's a lens that I speak from, but it's not like that is the purpose of it, you know, social work and the news, you know, it's just a place to vent and talk about, you know, current events or stories of interest. You know, we covered the story about the two mental health advocates committing suicide because, you know, for me, that's like a, you know, I worked crisis work. So I saw a lot of that in the moment crisis.
Yeah.
And, you know, even, you know, finding out that people we had gone and seen had completed suicide, you know, it's like, once you see that, like that piece of it.
It's close to home.
Yeah. I mean, like we were talking about the financial, like it could be any of us. That to me opened my eyes of mental health crisis can hit anybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, just like, you know, when I was going through that trauma I was telling you about, I was still seeing clients.
Yeah. 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 And you're trying to hold it together and act like everything's normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was still seeing clients. Yeah. You know? So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Definitely is interesting. Well, yeah. Well, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah.
You know,
thanks for having me.
No problem. Yeah. Do you want to tell the people where they can find your podcast at?
Oh, yeah. So we're What Are You Bringing to the Table podcast. We're on Apple, Spotify, Anchor. That's the platform we use. I think there's a couple places out there. Other, you know, all the places you find podcasts.
Yeah.
We do have a Facebook page, What Are You Bringing to the Table podcasts on Facebook. Yeah, post stories that you want us to talk about. Send us stories that you want to talk about.
I sent you a few.
Did you? Yes, you did. Yeah. Yes, you have sent me a few. Yeah. Yeah. So we try to record weekly, you know. During the summer it was a little bit hard, you know, going out and doing stuff. We played disc golf, so it's like we played tournaments, and so some weekends we weren't able to record. But right now we got a good mode going. We're recording on Tuesday nights, and then I usually get it edited and put out by Friday. So
all right,
you know, we try to do it weekly, so tight. Check us out. Warning, we are very liberal. We are not Trump fans.
They are.
And I do a lot of cussing, so it's not meant for people who don't like cussing, you know. So it's fun. It's a good time.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, man. It was fun.
And peace.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.